This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast, designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region, and thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of August 26th, 2024. Most of the rank and file of the Phoenix Police Department are members of an influential labor union that negotiates working conditions with the city. The Phoenix Law Enforcement Association has released a report it says was written by experts who found several significant inaccuracies in Justice Department findings against Phoenix. Matthew Casey reports.
The report says dozens of incidents the feds cite as police violence are factually or mostly inaccurate when cross-checked with records released by the city of Phoenix. One of the authors contributes to a pro-police website called Save Phoenix. An article on the site links to a podcast posted in June, days after the feds issued findings. Travis Yates told listeners that federal oversight is unconstitutional.
If you read the 10th Amendment, there is no right of the federal government to be involved in anything in a local government, including law enforcement.
Yates says he worked for the Tulsa Police Department for 30 years. A union spokesperson says the group did not commission the report, but members were aware the authors were curious to do their own analysis. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In politics news. A three-day court hearing wrapped up Wednesday over whether a criminal case against Arizona's so-called fake electors should be dismissed. From the politics desk, Wayne Shetsky reports.
Defense attorneys argue the case violates a law that bars litigation designed to silence a political opponent's constitutional rights. Assistant Attorney General Nick Klingerman says the law only applies when the prosecution is used as a pretext to penalize individuals engaging in otherwise lawful activity. He says that doesn't apply to 16 remaining defendants in Arizona's fake electors case, who are accused of engaging in fraud and forgery in an attempt to undermine President Biden's victory over former President Donald Trump in Arizona in 2020. But Klingerman acknowledged the inherent difficulty he faces because the newly expanded state law has not been litigated before.
The only thing I'll say on that is challenging, but other than that, I mean, that's what we get paid to do.
It will be weeks before the judge issues a ruling on the defendant's motion to dismiss the case, which isn't scheduled to go to trial until January 2026. Wayne Shutsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. So how well do you know the Grand Canyon State? KJZZ's A to Z quiz will test your knowledge of all things Arizona. Like, where in Arizona is the mail delivered by mules? That's one of this week's questions. Try the A to Z quiz at play.kjzz.org. Now from KJZZ's original production, we look at how zoos went from a rich man's menagerie to educational institutions. Here's co-host Lauren Gilger.
For this summer's edition of the Journal of Arizona History, researcher Courtney Lamb wrote about the early days of zoos, when they were more like roadside attractions. As Lamb told the show's Sam Dingman, for a long time, zoos were a place to display not only animals, but also the egos of the eccentric men who owned them.
They were very much created by people who were very wealthy and very connected and considered themselves, often they were both hunters and conservationists. So they had an interest that had to do with feeling an ownership of the land and of the animals on the land, and therefore for some of them also feeling a responsibility towards making sure that those animals were propagated. And zoos were a way to do that, and also to show off power and that you had access to these animals and that you could transport them. So that, you know, played on a long, centuries-long tradition of menageries and wealthy, you know, monarchs having menageries of their own.
Well, a couple of those interesting characters, one is Frank Murphy. I found a very interesting news item from him in the 1912 tombstone epitaph that basically talks about his menagerie, to use your word, Courtney. And how remarkable it seemed back in 1912. It says here that he has two mountain lions, two wild cats, a badger, two civet cats, three foxes, two black-tailed deer, a black eagle, a raven, a guinea pig, and four monkeys.
Yeah, quite a collection, quite a random collection. he was a Prescott Railroad baron. And so he started this private zoo. And yeah, there were very much these characters who just sort of decided that attaching yourself, especially to exotic animals, was desirable, and it indicated something positive about you.
It's kind of interesting to think about this being a period where if you were going to be the proprietor of the zoo, you had to own the land, you had to have the collection, and then you also had to have the know-how to care for these animals. Our producer actually flagged another really interesting piece about another figure in this curious history, Harry, quote, Indian Miller, who we should say was not indigenous, but that's a nickname that he apparently went by. This very interesting item in the Winslow Mail from 1925 about how he encounters this guy who says he has two eagles to sell, and Miller buys the eagles from him, but then realizes they can't fly. So he ends up just taking care of them and teaching them how to fly, and they end up becoming fixtures at his personal zoo.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you're talking to the right person, because my master's thesis was actually about Harry Miller, Harry Indian Miller, who did spend, who spent two decades pretending to be an Apache Indian, which he was absolutely not. And he would regularly get mauled by these animals because he handled them a lot, because this idea of, so what if you're not a rich person, you're showing off that you have a connection to the animals by handling them a lot.
Yeah. So tell us how do we get from this period of time where the zoo is more associated with this kind of individual eccentric figure and into a time when it becomes kind of a major anchor institution of a city?
The professionalization of zoos really, in America especially, really took off and really was formulated in the 70s because of these pressures, animal rights and animal liberation movements. A lot of very legitimate questions that the zoos didn't necessarily have great answers for, because they had been doing something that was very established for a very long time, and their expertise was dialed into doing it that way. So making that shift took a while, and it was contentious. It was really batting down the hatches in a lot of ways, of not wanting to engage with the critics too much, or of pushing aside the criticism. But meanwhile, they were in fact professionalizing the whole thing. You couldn't just show up. You know, it changed in the era of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. You couldn't just show up and say, "I'd love to be a zookeeper." I mean, we see this in this Reed Park Zoo. It was just a parks and rec guy being like, let's have some animals, and then he just kind of made it happen. Whether that's good or bad, it's not the question. He was able to do that. And then, so moving past that to where you needed a degree, and there were apprenticeships, and there were people with expertise in biology and zoology, was, I think, a response to all of this, these questions of, we can't just be amusement parks with living collections.
Right. Yeah. But what about the transition from, the Reed Park Zoo is a 501c3 nonprofit, same for the Phoenix Zoo. That's very different than, the private menagerie of an eccentric collector who's charging you money when you're driving along Route 66. That must have been a pretty significant transition, too, to shift public perception of these things from the realm of private ownership to a kind of public resource. How did that happen?
So if you read the history of zoos in America, some people have said, look, there was, they positioned it as, yes, there was a change in messaging at this time because of these pressures of the environmental movement and species extinction and so on, but that the actual practices of how the animals are kept, which animals are kept, how big are the collections, how diverse, how many types of animals are there, that the practices weren't that different. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for the practices to catch up to the messaging. But we also had, as a response to all that in the 80s, especially in Arizona, an era of sanctuaries. That became the new idea that you would have. So, for instance, Keepers of the Wild Nature Park is somebody who had worked in Vegas, you know, for animals that had been used and axed there. You know, that's a different kind of positioning of what this facility is. But ultimately, you go, it's animals in cages or enclosures. You know, it's sort of the same, but the thinking behind it, the intention behind, that's what we see again and again in zoo history. What is the intention behind it? And then physically, what is it like when you're there? Well, the physical part tends to be very recognizable throughout history.
Yeah. Zoo layout is sort of applying human organizational philosophy to the natural world. I think you were alluding earlier, Courtney, to the fact that the philosophy behind the layout and messaging of zoos has really started to evolve. So tell us about some of the more avant-garde or cutting-edge ways of organizing zoos that are shifting that.
Multi-species enclosures. That's a big change that I'm seeing more and more, that there's an understanding that you get so used to seeing them sort of isolated in small groups, you know, with a label next to them. And it can be quite thrilling and shocking to see a huge herd running across the desert sands, to see them in their habitat like that. And I think that is something maybe more zoos are trying to pull in to help us understand what the stakes are. But also, it's a different way. We haven't been encouraged to think of ecosystems this way for a long, long time. So if we are being steered towards that by zoos, I think that can only be a positive thing.
Yeah. Well, Courtney Lamb is a PhD student at UC Riverside, and she wrote about the history of zoos for the Journal of Arizona History.
I appreciate it so much. I could talk about zoos forever, so this is a real pleasure for me.
In Tribal Natural Resources, which is supported in part by a grant from the Katina Foundation. It's been 2 weeks since Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays sent a letter to the U.S. Forest Service asking the agency to conduct an additional environmental impact study, or EIS, for the Pinon Plain uranium mine. As Gabriel Pietrazio reports, there's still no answer.
Mays is waiting for a formal response from the Forest Service, which tells KJZZ News that it is still reviewing the letter and its recommendations.
We really feel strongly that that EIS is massively outdated. It's almost 40 years old. Obviously, we want to wait and see what the Forest Service has to say, but we're not going to back down on this one.
The federal agency says the mine's operator, Energy Fuels, is currently in compliance. In a statement, the mining company says the EIS, originally authorized in 1986, was later reaffirmed by the Forest Service in 2012. But in her letter, Mays cited concern over the risk that flooding poses on contamination to the Havasupai tribe's precious water supply. Gabriel Pietrazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In science news, in southeastern Arizona, a new type of tarantula has been discovered in the Chiricahua Mountains. Ignacio Ventura reports.
A field trip to the mountains by a group of scientists in 2018 led to the discovery of what is being called the Aphonopelma jacobii tarantula. Brent Hendrickson, a biology professor at Millsaps College in Mississippi, was part of the group.
It had the coloration. You have these really bright orange hairs on its abdomen. It has kind of this grayish color to it. It just didn't look right to me to be that species. But then, you know, the way that we ended up determining that it was indeed new is that we did all this genetic testing.
Researchers used 20 specimens to diagnose and describe the tarantula. The researchers' findings were published in the scientific journal Zookies. Ignacio Ventura, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In business news, both presidential candidates want to eliminate taxes on tips, but is it bad policy? Here's Mark Brody.
Our next guest is not in favor of the plan. Adam Chatero is a professor of law at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. He joins me to talk about this. And Adam, why don't you think this is a good idea?
Yeah, it's bad both from a theory perspective and from a policy perspective. So let me start with a theory, right?
Sure.
The income tax should be imposed on all income, which includes wages and salary. And tips are a form of wages and salary. So it doesn't make sort of theoretical sense to say, okay, we're going to tax you on the part you get from your employer, but the part that your employer essentially doesn't pay, but it comes from the customers, that's income, but we're not going to tax that. So that's the theoretical problem with the idea. The policy problem is that it creates huge inefficiency and distorts the economy and will lead to sort of dynamic changes in game playing that you can try to stop, but then that's going to significantly complicate the code.
So I want to ask you about the game playing, because you write about this in the sense that you're almost, in your mind, incentivizing people to not take jobs that don't involve tips, because your entire income would be taxed, as opposed to a job where part of your income would be taxed, but tips, another part, would not be.
Right. So the example you might use is somebody's trying to think about, should I become a bartender or should I become a public school teacher? And let's just pretend for theory's sake that they both make $40,000 a year. But the bartender gets $10,000 in tips and the teacher doesn't. So if you're thinking about it from an economic perspective, you would much rather be a bartender than a teacher. We've created an incentive for people to pick bartending over teaching. And that's not to say that bartending isn't a noble thing. And we need bartenders. And there's nothing like a well-made cocktail, let me tell you. But we don't want the tax system to force people one direction or the other, right? The whole idea, and it's actually a Republican idea, is that the market should determine what people do and let them follow their preferences. But if you tip the scale one way or the other through the tax system, you're going to get people going one way or the other, even if they'd rather go the other way.
That seems like a very sort of theoretical argument, but like, in the real world, we know, for example, like a college professor and a bartender probably don't make the same amount of money. So are you really disincentivizing somebody, let's say, from going to, you know, get an MBA or something, who's going to, you know, be an executive at a company, versus somebody who's going to work in a more service-oriented job? Or are you just concerned about the types of jobs where the salaries are closer to what a tipped worker might earn?
Right. I mean, it depends on what you're motivated by. But if you're motivated by, you know, what's my after-tax return, right? How much do I get to keep when the day is done? Somebody who's going to go into business or you know, earn $100,000 a year probably isn't going to say, yes, but some portion of my much lower bartender income is tax-free. We're not going to lose people to bartending from high-income jobs. But anybody who's earning about the same amount, if they're acting rationally and economically rationally, is going to pick the job where less of the income is taxed.
Is there a way, and both former President Trump and Vice President Harris have talked about the idea of wanting to allow tipped workers to keep more of their income, right? Not have to pay it in taxes. Is there a way to let that happen? Because I would think that would be a good outcome from a societal standpoint to some degree, as long as you can make up for the lost revenue in the government. But if workers are able to keep more of their money, they're probably going to spend more of it. That creates more sales tax, more jobs for people, that kind of thing.
Right. So if your question is, like, should we help people who are low income folks, right, who need help, who are struggling in the economy, the answer to that is almost certainly yes, because there are all kinds of follow-on economic effects like you just mentioned. The question really is, what's the best way to do that? And the best way to do that is an across-the-board, neutrally applicable rule, like, for instance, lowering taxes on everyone. It isn't picking winners and losers. And that's the problem with this proposal, is that we are essentially saying to the world, tipped workers are more worthy in some way than other people who make the same amount, who have the same economic struggles they do. But we're going to give a tax break to these people and not to those.
I'm curious how you see this proposal in the context of what I think most of us, or at least many of us, have experienced in terms of more and more places asking customers, would you like to add a tip?
Right. So during the pandemic, right, we saw this shift in tipping culture, and most folks are really frustrated by it. This would supercharge that problem. because now, all right, I'm not going to ask my employer for a higher wage. What I'm going to do is try to extract more tips out of my customers because I keep more of that. And so that's a problem. But the other problem is right now, right, there are certain people we tend to tip, right? Culturally, we tip these people and not those people. Well, if suddenly tips are not subject to tax, right, I can imagine my doctor or my accountant or my lawyer saying to me, look, I'll charge you half of what I normally charge if you'll consider a tip. And so what we will see is this pressure, this dynamic response, this pressure for people we don't normally tip to start asking for tips. And I don't think we want to go there.
In addition to sort of the awkwardness of, you know, a physician, you know, filling out your chart and saying, okay, by the way, you know, they hand you a little screen and say, what kind of tip would you like to add? Are there other sort of economic issues with that or policy issues with having more types of services that are soliciting tips?
Well, if we allow tips, right, to go untaxed, then there are huge problems with it. Because what we're basically saying is, depending on the kind of business you're in and whether you're customer facing or not, we're going to give you this fabulous tax break. And so what we're going to end up doing is having tips start sort of spreading and expanding, and that's going to be problematic. And we're going to lose a lot more revenue than we think we are.
If we are going to keep the status quo where taxes are paid on tips, what does that mean for employers or states in which employers are allowed to pay their employees less, assuming that they are made up? The difference is made up by tips. For example, states that are allowed, where tip workers are allowed to be paid less than minimum wage, with the assumption that they will be brought up and maybe even beyond that by the tips they earn.
Right. Well, so there's been pressure in a lot of states and also at the federal level to do away with this reduced minimum wage for tipped workers. If we allow tips to go tax-free, any pressure to raise that minimum wage, I think, will disappear because the workers will say, we don't want more minimum wage because that's going to get taxed.
Yeah.
We want to figure out how to get more tips.
All right. That is Adam Chodoro, professor of law at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Adam, good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Great to talk to you, too.
And finally, in Fronteras news, a local ordinance passed in Pima County will require contractors to follow regulations to protect their workers from extreme heat. From the Fronteras desk there, Elisa Resnick has more.
Under the new ordinance, all Pima County employers and contractors must provide heat protection measures for outdoor workers, like access to water and shade and breaks and shifts. Pima County Board of Supervisor Chair Adelita Grijalva says the effort began earlier this year.
I visited a lot of the departments, wastewater, a lot of our employees that work outside, and, you know, a couple of them have a little umbrella, but most of the time they're out, and it was a concern to me. And so I started asking about what protections we provide, and that sort of was the catalyst for moving forward.
The ordinance has been active for county employers for the last 30 days, and supervisors voted to extend it to county contractors and subcontractors in a 4-1 vote this month. Grijalva says Pima is the first county in Arizona to pass such an ordinance. Elisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ, your news